Ready? Okay. I'll ask the clerk to read, announce the case.
The court will now call Javert Caparubian versus the state. The man pleading the court, Mr. Alberto Herrera, to argue for the appellant. Mr. John Lacunas, to argue for the state.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Alberto Herrera for Jairo Casarubios. This is a distressing case in that a 26-year-old soccer coach is accused of indecency with a child and sexual contact with a child. When this case went to trial, the state went to great lengths to discuss how the complainant was naive and how the soccer coach was grooming this child for this molestation that they're alleging, that they convicted him of. Now, given that they brought this issue to the forefront, trial counsel tried to bring in evidence as to the complainant's pornography use on her cell phones. A hearing was held outside the purview of the jury. Evidence was presented, and the trial court decided to limit and or not allow trial counsel to go into the pornography. Now, there are a variety of rules that would handle this, most of which would appear to say, no, you can't bring in the prior sexual history of the victim into play. But when the state brings that as one of their points, I think a defendant has a right to defend himself, and I think limiting that cross-examination into that point is a violation of the 6th and 14th Amendment rights. He has a right to defend himself. The main point that the state was putting forward is that this young 14-year-old girl was naive, chaste, and could not possibly know about the things that she was testifying to. Her use, and the word massive is used in the record, her massive use of porn.com, okay, would give her that knowledge of those sexual positions that she testified to. Now, when you look at the state's evidence in total, she was examined. A rape kit was done. That person in the state's own brief says, can't tell if she's had sex or not. Just don't know. Can't go either way. Okay? So, where did she get the sexual knowledge? She claims that the only person that she slept with was my client. Yet, at another point, trial court did not allow text messages coming in from Manny, another young man who wanted to have sex with her, who had discussions about sex with her.
Mr. Herrera?
Yes, sir.
Where in the record is there any identification of what occurred in the terms of what Manny is supposed to have said?
It's not stated point blank because that was in the hearing that was held outside the presence of the jury.
So it's not in the record?
No, sir.
We don't know what Manny was saying to her.
Other than him, other than the messages being related to, I want to have sex with you. No, we don't know the details, no, sir. But we know it was, I want to have sex with you. And my whole point this morning is we're trying to show throughout the trial there was a pattern of this young lady has knowledge of sex. This young lady, you know, knows what she's doing. There are other ways for her to get that knowledge other than from my client. And the fact that we weren't able to present that hurt my client throughout the guilt and innocence stage and the punishment phase. One of the comments that they used was, the evidence is disgusting. How dare you groom this young lady? Well, when the jury hears that, they also talk about other victims in their closing argument. For example, they talk about, you know, if this young lady was 6 months younger, she wouldn't be eligible for probation. He'd have to go to prison. He'd have to go. Now, this is a young man. My client at the time had no convictions, had a good, hardworking family, etc. Okay? So for the state to say, you know what, if she were 6 months younger, she's not. It didn't happen when she was 6 months younger. You deal with the charge as the day it happened. You don't introduce those kind of arguments at the end. You don't talk about grooming somebody, because that implies active effort on the part of my client to prepare this young lady to be molested, to be raped, etc. So if they do that, I think we have a right to defend ourselves. Where else, you know, we're saying we didn't do it. So where else can she get this knowledge? Well, she can get it from porn.com. In their brief, they'll tell you, well, you know, we didn't really go into what porn.com's about. I'm sorry, I think it's self-explanatory. Porn.com is self-explanatory. Now, again, those parts of the records were sealed. Those were held away from the jury. These things were said and done. It's even in the state's own brief. All we're asking for is a chance to be able to defend ourselves. And given this litany of arguments on their part about the grooming, about, you know, about the sex, we have to be able to discuss it. I mean, I know the rules prevent it. You know, they prevent bringing their character into it. But in this case, they made it an issue. They brought it up. And I think we have every right to defend ourselves against that. Now, if we look at what was denied us, our right to defend ourselves, that's a constitutional right. I think if you do a harm analysis, this decision should be reversed. This should be reversed. The harm was egregious. It ran throughout the whole length of the trial. And then to boot, they add the improper jury argument at the end. If she were 6 months younger, no probation. That's a lot to overcome. That's a lot to overcome. And that's what we were faced with, is instance after instance after instance. Now, you're going to hear from the state where they talk about, well, I'm sorry, that, you know, his attorneys didn't really preserve very well. Well, they objected, had a hearing outside the presence of the jury, and the state ruled. I mean, I'm sorry, the judge ruled. How much more do we need to do to make our point? Now, there's case law that says there are really no magic words that are necessary, so as long as from the context and the meaning, the judge understands what we're doing. So if the judge thought enough to have a hearing outside the presence of the jury, I think we got our point across. I think that judge understood. Okay, I do think they erred in their judgment, and I do think that these errors caused our client great harm. That we were not able to overcome with a jury instruction or a motion for mistrial, this is the place we're coming to for justice. We need your help. We need to send the message that every defendant has a right to defend themselves, especially, and I'm not trying to say he has an absolute right to defend themselves and bring in things that shouldn't come in, but if the state opens the door, if they make her chastity, her virtue an issue, then we should be able to rebut that. And that's what I'm saying. We weren't able to rebut it. And we need to be able to defend ourselves. Again, going back to the jury argument, that's something you can't overcome. You start hearing words like disgusting. You start hearing, if she were only 6 months younger, send the message to the community. Send the message for law enforcement. Of course, let's give them 20 years. What's 20 years? So I ask you to look at the facts. Look at the harm that was caused to my client. And know that this is something that could not be overcome. Again, there were no magic words. I'm not saying that my predecessor ran the perfect trial. I'm not saying that. But he was understood enough by the judge for them to hold these hearings outside the presence of the jury.
Mr. Herrera?
Yes, sir.
Listen to your argument carefully, and I didn't hear you say a single thing about the conduct of your client as alleged in the indictments and
yes,
as presented in the evidence. And in particular, when we're talking about balancing and harm, that your client gave a statement that was recorded and was admitted to the jury that he found himself naked and under a naked 14-year-old girl and had no explanation for it. I don't know how I got there. Now, how is that structured in terms of a review of harm in the items you've talked about, which are all pointed towards the victim?
Yes, sir. And now, to be clear, I don't want to... When the first moment, I met with trial counsel, met with the client, went down to prison to see him, met with his family, talked to the DA's office, got their file, got the clerk's record, got everything. The first notice I got of that statement that you're referring to, Your Honor, was in the state's brief. I believe it's State's Exhibit 5,
yes,
if I remember correctly, wasn't provided to me. I did not know that existed. Trial counsel didn't make me aware. Families here, they didn't remember it either, and they sat through trial, every bit of it. So that, I don't know where it came from. I've talked to my client. He denies it adamantly.
Have you looked at the tape?
Yes, sir. Everything that was provided, I've looked at. Had to return it.
I said that on the tape. I watched it yesterday.
Yes, sir. The tape, Of his interview?
Yes.
Okay, the ones I reviewed, Your Honor, did not have an interview with my client where he says, I don't know how that happened. I have one with him denying it. I did not see one where he's accepting what you're saying, Your Honor.
I guess my memory's faulty from yesterday, but I don't think so.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. From Mr. Masuka?
Ms. Gunnish, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. May it please the court, counsel. Just as preliminary matters, I would point out to the court that points of error 1 and 4 were not preserved. If the court would like to go into the preservation argument, I would be glad to. Otherwise, the state will just rely on its brief for points of error 1 and 4. And regarding points of error 2 and 3, they also were not preserved because appellant's complaint on appeal, his whole complaint on appeal is that the judge's Rule 412 ruling was faulty. These do not comport with his objections at trial. The state did not brief that point, but I would remind the court that preservation of error is systemic and the court should address that on its own motion. Regarding point of error 2, appellant's arguing that this should have been let in as rebuttal. There were objections that it should have, these texts should have been let in for impeachment purpose. The problem is that the hearing was a hearing on admissibility, and appellant never authenticated the text messages. We don't know the date they were sent, the time they were sent. We don't know from what phone number they were sent. We don't know the sender's last name. And in reality, we don't even know the sender's first name. Manny is a nickname. Is it short for Herman, Emmanuel, Manuel, Manfred? We don't know because the texts were never authenticated. The defendant or defense counsel was wholly lacking in their offer of proof. So under Rule 901, the judge made the right decision. As far as point of error 3 goes, again, appellant has here today argued that his Sixth Amendment rights were violated. These objections were never made at trial, never once. The Court of Criminal Appeals has been very clear. If you want to argue on appeal that the right to confrontation was violated, you must make a confrontation objection at trial. And he says, well, but from the context, you should know. Well, I disagree wholly. This was a hearing. These hearings were hearings on admissibility. He would have to bring it up, the confrontation objection. He would have to bring it up. And we know from the record that defense counsel knew, or at least could identify, when she thought the confrontation clause was being violated, because later in trial she made that specific objection about a different piece of evidence. As far as point of error 3, under Rule 12, this is certainly the right decision. I don't think an argument that viewing pornography is not past sexual behavior passes the laugh test.
Well, now, wait a minute. The Waco court has said that what is contemplated by Rule 412 is sexual conduct, sexual intercourse, the act of sex, not tangential sexually related things. And the federal courts apply it that way. And our rules are drawn from the federal rules, and we have some guidance from how the federal courts apply the rules as to how we should apply them. And the genesis of Rule 412 was the Rape Shield Law that said that when consent is an issue, just because a woman has had sex in the past doesn't mean consensual sex in the past doesn't mean she consents to rape. This is not a past sexual act. This is pornography. And this goes to whether or not she had knowledge of some technical aspects of the sex act that she was testifying to. So I'm not so sure that 412 even applies in this case, and certainly the Waco court says it does not.
I see your point. I would reply that the...
In this case, you're not even talking about consent because it's statutory.
But appellant...
That's the purpose of 412, is it not? It's not to shield all the evidence out there. It's to say that we're not going to presume consent because in a situation of rape, just because consent has been given in the past to someone else.
I think the purpose of 412 is to keep the victim from being tried and to keep the victim from being tried on past acts that the jury might find offensive. Regardless, appellant didn't establish any relevance here.
The purpose of Rule 412 was to dispel that notion that, say, prostitutes can't be raped, or just because there's a sexual history doesn't mean that you always give consent.
Well,
your position is that 412 is just out there to protect victims from ever having to talk about anything related to their sexual knowledge, their sexual acumen, their anything sexual in their lives?
No, ma'am. And I believe in my brief I stated that even if it is as appellant claims her basis of knowledge of sexual acts, that he would have to prove that by showing that what was contained on that website is substantially similar to what she testified to.
So you're saying that part of error preservation wasn't?
I mean, I'm saying they didn't prove any relevance at all because they stopped. The offer of proof stopped too early. They said, have you visited porn.com? Yes. And then they stopped. They never went into what was what's contained on porn.com. And there are very specific things that she describes. We don't know if it's on that website. And we're not to speculate, as appellant has invited this court to do, what is on that website. And the court also mentioned that it was keeping the evidence out under Rule 404B because it was more prejudicial than probative. I think that speaks for itself. I mean, a person's pornography watching habits are highly personal and highly embarrassing. When we're talking about a teenage girl and having that exposed to a courtroom full of strangers.
Well, isn't being accused of sexual misconduct as a defendant highly embarrassing as well? Don't we balance the rights of both the victim and the
If you're talking about the probative value, I would say so. But when you factor in appellant's confession that says that she was performing these acts with him, then I think the probative value of the pornography, it minimizes that probative value. If there are no other questions, I will thank you for your time.
Thank you to both counsel. Appreciate your arguments and your briefs.
Rebuttal.
I'm sorry?
What? So you have a rebuttal.
Oh, do you have a rebuttal?
Yeah, may I have just a brief
Yeah, please
rebuttal?
Do. I forgot.
Really quick, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, I want to follow up on that question. How do we presume as a court, if the record isn't developed at the trial level, that these pornographic websites had that information?
And that's actually, Your Honor, what I was going to speak to the court about. When that line of questioning was begun, the court says, time out, let's have a hearing outside the presence. So you, as the sitting judge in the trial court, would have heard all of our arguments. Counsel talks about, well, they didn't prove up. They didn't make an offer of proof. Well, the judge already shut us down. She, already heard everything.
So you're saying you don't have to make an offer of proof?
No, I'm saying
what was excluded?
We do, but we were shut down to begin with. Also, if you look at the record...
Are you saying that the trial court precluded you from making a proper offer of proof?
That's what I believe, yes, Your Honor. Okay? And if you look at the record on this court, now, in the heading for the trial court, there are two names on there. There were, according to the record, only two judges sat to hear this. And obviously, I can't present witnesses this morning, but I have more than 20 witnesses. I'll say there were probably five different judges sitting hearing this trial. Okay? That kind of hurts my client's chance to get a fair trial because nobody knew the whole story.
But you don't raise that as a point of error on appeal?
No, ma'am. No, but I would just want the court to be aware that there are a lot of things in this case that don't make sense. I mean, the text for Manny, the porn from porn.com, you know, we couldn't get into it because we were shut down. As to the confession, Judge, when you look at the confession, this man, his English is probably 40%, 50%. I'm not sure he understood what he was saying because in everything that he's presented to us, he's like, I didn't do it. That's what he said to us, Judge. And that's why we're here. That's why the crowd behind you, those are all soccer parents who raise money to pay fees to be here. They're behind him. They believe he did nothing wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Okay. Now, so thank you for your briefs and your good, excellent arguments. And your case is submitted and you're excused. Thank you. And we will stand in recess for 20 minutes till 10:30 when our next case is called.
All rise.
Excuse me.